Welcome back to another edition of Step by Step with Michael Boucher Filmmaker. I'm Nick Bowman.
I'm Nyan David.
I'm William Chaffin.
And in this one, we're kind of getting in, going to get into a little bit about post-production, about Guilt, and where we are at this moment that we're recording.
Yes. So, so where we're at right now, so we're in mid-November.
Yeah, we're in mid-November.
Movie is edited, color graded, visual effects are done, credits are done, music's composed. Or score's done, I should say. We are working on sound design, which is always the last piece for me. Mm-hmm. Our sound designer, Salim, good friend of Naeem's.
Yes.
He's out in California.
We wrote our first script together.
Oh, very cool. Very cool. He has told me he will have the first cut of the whole audio mix next weekend. So about a week from now. And basically I'll listen to that and send him notes on tweaks, and then we'll be done. So we'll be done with the whole. So when he's done with sound design, then the movie's done. Because then all I got to do is lay the sound design in with the movie and render it out, and we're done.
You know what's crazy?
So probably early December.
This conversation has got me an idea for my feature. I'm gonna write down a note.
Okay.
You know what? Real quick, notes come from very random places.
Very random places. Most of mine happen on the toilet or in the shower. It's just gonna be that way. Yeah. Or I'm driving in the car by myself.
You're seeing this now, ladies and gentlemen.
Yeah, you're
seeing
this
happening.
Idea,
and it's going to be playing out right in the middle right now. See? Like,
you're seeing inspiration at its finest. So that's where we're at. Now, how we got here, we've already told you about all of the prep. Yeah. Development prep, shooting, all that stuff. I talked a little bit about how I edited. So I edit the movie in sequences and kind of like chapters on a DVD, which I've talked about in the past, but basically, whatever we filmed that weekend, the 2 weeks in between before we shot again, I would edit everything that we shot, and I would do it in sequences.
That's how Kevin Smith used to talk about how he used to do it.
I love to edit in sequences because then that sequence is sort of done, and I can kind of put it away, at least the first cut of it. Now, one thing we did that was interesting that we sort of experimented with is when I would finish all of that editing, you guys would come over to the house and watch those sequences and give me some notes. Mm-hmm. And we did that, I think, after the first 2 weekends. Mm-hmm. And then you made a point, Naeem, where you had said, it was the cemetery scene, where they were Elizabeth is talking to Olivia and her friend, and Emily, and you were like, the scene seems long, but I don't know how it plays in the rest of the movie. Mm-hmm. And what I was basically trying to do is just kind of save time and say, hey, let's work on each sequence, and I can just put the sequences in order, and we're done. But you made a great point. I was like, yeah, that's true. We don't know how this plays with what comes before and after. So from that point on, we stopped doing that. I would just edit the sequences until I was happy with them, put it away, save them. And then I love it in Final Cut because I can save everything in its own little sequence called a compound clip. Premiere does it a little bit. Same thing, but
it's pretty much.
And then basically I would have all the sequences in these clips and I would just pull the clip down and that was the whole sequence. But then I could go into the clip to pull up all the individual little shots, the original cut of it. So I love how Final Cut does that. It makes it seamless and easy and I can just constantly be moving through stuff. I've lost my place a few times and been like, what the fuck did I just do? But you know, that happens. So then I just finished the move, so I would just edit the sequences, put them away, and then just sort of forget about it, which was nice because it gave me a break from whatever that was, right? Then we'd shoot, I'd edit again, and same process over and over again. We wrapped shooting August 8th, funny enough, my wife's birthday. And then I edited those scenes that week, which I believed ended on Friday the 13th. Ooh. And I sent, so I had the scenes done, put them all in order, rendered it out into like just a basic HD file, which I then compressed.
It's a sign.
Right?
And
then I compressed it so it was small. And then I uploaded it to my Dropbox and I sent it to you guys, Ben, our DP, Nathan, our sound guy. I feel like there's a couple other people that I sent it to. None of the actors could see it. I didn't want them. The thing about actors is they're not great at giving you feedback on an edit of a movie because they're too stuck in their performance.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Totally get it.
Yeah.
How they should be, right? That's not a criticism. That's just how it is.
Yeah.
So I needed objective stuff. So I sent it to you guys, and then everybody gave me notes back that following week. And that's when I was talking about another episode where you gave me that note about this needs to be trimmed down. And it just, I still to this day don't know exactly what it was. I remember reading it the night before, and the next day I went in there and I just started gutting shit. And what I realized was in the edit, here's what was interesting, that I didn't realize in the script, that I realized in the edit, was in this story, I was creating sort of, because there's this Catholic exorcism element to it, right? Mm-hmm. But it's not an exorcism movie, right? So there's a whole banishment thing and this kind of stuff. So I kept wanting to make sure that the rules of the world were coming through clearly to the audience, because I didn't want them to go in expecting the exorcist or exorcism of the
right,
New Rose
right.
or something like that. I wanted them to know this is not that movie. Right? It has elements of that, it has influences of that, but it's not that movie. So the ending is going to be a little different. Mm-hmm. Right? Well, how they go about whatever it is they go about is going to be different. But I realized I got a little repetitive on some of those rules throughout the movie. And it just not something that stuck out to me in the script. And to be honest with you, not a lot of people commented on it either. So I noticed it in the edit. So I was like, okay, that's got to go. So then I went through and just sort of picked and choose where I wanted the information to be throughout the movie to sort of make sure that the world was still created. There's still a couple moments where a couple of things get repeated, but I feel like it's important, so I didn't mind it. So that's the stuff I sort of ended up trimming out, and that's what sort of tightened up the scenes, really, for me. And I cut it from, I don't know, 82 minutes to 75, something like that. But I already had, like I said before, I designed the movie. I sort of know how the shots are going to go together. When I have very specific shots, like an intro shot or a dramatic moving shot, I sort of know where those things are going to piece together. And I've done this enough with other projects and editing that I sort of know how I want to piece stuff together. Mm-hmm. What I don't anticipate and what I like to sort of find in the moment is the pace of the performances. Mm-hmm. So I will find that in the edit. That's the one thing I don't plan. So sort of like when I write scripts, I don't plan my dialogue. I let my dialogue sort of be my free writing.
Right.
Which is always why that's what I revise the most of in the script form. Because it's not planned. Like the structure, the characters, the descript, all that stuff's planned. The dialogue is not. When I edit, I know the shots, what shots I'm going to use, where they're going to go, all that kind of, how the scene's going to lay out. But I don't know how fast am I going to cut back and forth between this dialogue or that dialogue. And I let the performances tend to dictate it. Ooh, I really want to see them when they say that, or really want to see that character's reaction when she says that, or I tend to find that in the moment. So I like that there's a plan and things are organized and I have a design to it, but then there's still room for discovery. Mm-hmm. And that's sort of the balance I've found for myself. That's how I like to edit. What about you? Like, how do you like to plan? Just curious, just to give people a different perspective on editing from a director's point of view.
Yeah. With me, it's kind of like the same way. I'll have, you know, I'll go in there and I'll organize all the footage. And then knowing on set what takes I'm going to use and potentially what I'm going to do makes it easier. That way I can just go in there. And since as an example for this last one that I did, I'm editing on my laptop, my MacBook Pro, and it's a little bit laggy. So I wanted to, and I shot, you know, ProRes, so it helps. So it's like I'm using, you know, like a DSLR type thing. I'll just label everything, label the takes I want to use, import that and work from that. So, and then I'll just go in there and just, I'll focus on one scene at a time, get the footage that I'm going to use, watch it all, and then organize it. Mm-hmm. And then later, I'll do like an L cut or a J cut or figure out how the pacing is or anything like that. But I just want to get the structure of the scene on the timeline.
Yep.
And then I start piecing and chopping.
So you cut on the timeline.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, see, I do the same thing. I like having, I'm like, okay, well, this portion of the scene is going to be these shots. So I'll get all those shots in. What I actually do is I pull all the shots on there and I go in and I lay in a the color grade thing and I color correct.
Okay.
So I adjust my exposure with the shot. So that way it's already somewhat adjusted. And then that way I don't have to do it in all the individual little clips.
See, what I do is, I do that last, but if I know the scene is just one scene and I lit it all the same way, I'll put the adjustment layer on top of all of it, put my color grade, and then I'll adjust specific shots for the certain things to make it all match.
Yeah, now I go back in later and I adjust the exposure more to make sure, like, I remember there was a scene we shot between Detective Mattingly and Matt Greenman out in front of the house. And the sun was, like, hitting her way more than it was him when we shot her take versus his. So he was a little darker. So I adjusted the exposure on the individual shot, and then I went back through the scene and darkened hers to match his. Like, that was just something in color correction that I needed to do. And then color grade, I tend to, when the movie's done, mm-hmm. I'll lay in the color grade thing that that Final Cut has, and then I adjust, like, the shadows and the highlights yeah. and midtones, and I adjust all that stuff to get it how I want it to look, and then I create a color. Like, I like kind of a colder bluish tint mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. to most movies that I do, because they're darker, and it gives it a colder sort of feel. So I did that, and that's sort of how I created my LUT, which is basically the color grade. Mm-hmm. Now, obviously, bigger budgets, you bring in a colorist where they can go in, we're going to bring out some of the red from this shot, and we're going to bring out some of the brown. You know, you can get really specific, right?
You can really do that, tedious. And you can do that in Premiere and Final Cut, but right. it's just like, if I don't need to, I won't do it.
Right, same here. Yeah. I tend to create sort of just a look for the movie.
And I make sure...
And then from that, it's more about the color timing and making sure that they match. So exactly. The scene looks seamless, basically.
If the lighting on set is good, you don't really have to do much.
You don't have to do a lot.
You just have to, you know, white balance it maybe. But yeah. other than that, it's already, if you do your job right on set, it's pretty seamless.
Yeah. So that's why, like, for a micro budget movie, don't pay someone a color.
Yeah.
And if you're like, well, not, because I had somebody who texted me recently and said, do you know an editor or color grader? And I was like, do it yourself. I'm not very good at it. I said, then practice. Mm-hmm. Like, oh, yeah. I was like, don't pay someone else to do it.
Yeah.
I mean, you're just doing a short film, dude.
Everybody is waiting for somebody else. Yeah.
Yeah. When you are dependent on other people,
you're not going to get any
You're always dependent on other people.
Yeah.
The more independent and self-reliant you can be, mm-hmm. the more shit you're going to get done.
I learned that.
And it doesn't, when you're making a short film, it doesn't fucking matter.
Yeah.
You're not going to Hollywood off your short film anymore. This is not fucking David Sandberg from, you know, whatever his first movie's called. Like, it doesn't work that way. Just stop. Doesn't work that way.
It's a lottery ticket.
Lottery ticket, man. It's a lottery ticket.
Yeah.
So stop thinking that way. Even on your first feature, right? If you're making movies for basically nothing, do as much yourself as you can. Mm-hmm. The only thing that I would even spend money on or bring people in is sound.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Unless you have gone to school or have trained yourself on audio engineering, which is just such a definitive fine skill.
Yeah.
Or, you know, like I said, or train yourself. You know, bought the software, learned it, and trained yourself. That's cool. That's awesome. Be your own sound designer then. But beyond sound, there's no reason, you know, or music, right? You may not be a musician. Totally get that. But doesn't necessarily mean you need a composer, right? You got Soundstripe, you got audio, you got all these places you can pull music
exactly.
from. These are the things that you should be doing. Limit yourself. That was the experiment I did on Confined. I literally think I had three people on crew. Mm-hmm. I had a sound recordist. I had a stunt coordinator for 2 or 3 days.
Yeah.
I had a special effects makeup artist for 2 days. And my post-production was a sound designer and a visual effects artist. I had a visual effects person do basically the muzzle flare for gunfire. Mm-hmm. Sound designer who did the dialogue and sound effects. And then I actually mixed the movie myself because I pulled music from Soundstripe. I laid in the music and then I laid in the audio once he was done editing and I mixed it myself in Final Cut.
And Isotope for audio, if you're just starting out, does 70% of the fucking work for you when you lay it in. If you know the basics of audio, and if you use Isotope...
It's a thing called YouTube. You can Google it.
Yeah. you'll be fine because... Right. It really does. All you have to do is just make tiny adjustments, but it really just makes all the audio just
blend
together, right. and it's just all
levels
sounds
it
the
out.
Same.
Yeah, that's all you really need, you know, because there's EQs and all this stuff that you can do to it. So for a short film, don't spend money. Don't
overanalyze it.
Yeah, it's just a short film. It's going to be 5-10 minutes of your, you know.
Yeah, and you're learning your voice. You're learning your style.
Short films should not be a showcase. It should be your film school.
Yeah.
So. I know we're getting into that side of it, but when it comes to editing, do as much of it as you can yourself. Do not bring other people in to do this.
It's like Kevin Smith. Why do you want to give your baby to somebody else?
Right. Exactly.
That's what he said.
And there's so many more directors now that are their own editors, or at least started out that way. You know what I mean?
And at this stage in the game, I can sit with an editor, and we can talk back and forth, but honestly, I want to do the editing myself and then go to somebody and be like, what do you think of this? That way, like, I'm doing it
from my point of view.
That's where you and I come into play, like, as both being directors and editors, and come in, like, you'll send me something and I'll give you my feedback on where I think maybe a cut needs to be revised, and you'll do the same thing for me. And Nick's done that for us as well, and it's like the whole purpose of that is just to have an outside voice or outside pair of eyes look at it, right? If you're your own editor. It's no different than as a director working with an editor, which I've done a couple times, because like I said, the only time I've not edited my own stuff is when I was broke and didn't have my own editing system. So in those moments, though, I still knew, like, the movie was still designed. I still knew how things were going to cut. And I would frustrate them sometimes because they're like, well, I can only cut this one way. And I'm like, yeah, I know. Well, yeah, but you didn't give me any choices. I'm like, yeah, no. I didn't want you to have choices.
Yeah.
That's how I want it to look. That's how you want it to look? Yeah, that's how I want it to look. Like it or don't like it, I don't give a fuck. That's how I want it to look.
And that's,
now, earlier in my career, I did less of that than I do now because I didn't know. Right, so you learn these things, but again, this is why you should be doing it yourself.
So you know,
because there's no better way to direct someone in a job than if you've done the job yourself. Whether it's editing, acting, running camera, you know, doing sound design, whatever, is no better way to do that. You know, the only thing that I have not personally done myself is create music, because I'm not a musician.
Yeah,
it's the only thing I've run boom, I've edited sound. Badly, for the most part, but I've done it. You know, so I've done all of those things in order. The only other one I haven't done is visual effects. I never sat down and learned visual effects because I don't do a lot of it. I don't have a lot of visual effects in my movies.
I think Cody or Josh. I think Cody sent me this packet, like a folder with like blood squirts and stuff like that. And I did my own visual effects on Velma and some other things.
Okay,
so I'll do some of. So it's either like digital,
plugins and stuff.
It'll be either be digital or practical. So I've done those types of things.
So what I would do, like with Gunfire, like when I did on Confined, because I edited the movie in sequences, when I had a sequence done and I knew that once the movie was edited, what I would do is I would render out just the sequences that had the gunfire and I would send those to my visual effects guy. He would spend a few days putting in the gunfire, bullet holes, blood splatter, whatever we're adding. Josh Luckett actually did my visual effects on Confined. And he did a great one where he had like ricochets off the wall and stuff. And I've showed people that and they're like, wow, that's really cool. And I was like, yeah, no, that's real.
Yeah.
And they're like, what? I was like, yeah, we just shot up a house. And they're like, well, how'd you flip the table? Because there's a scene in there where it cuts to the one guy coming in, which is Chris Tatone. He comes in, he comes around the corner. And then when it cuts back to the other guy, he's down behind the coffee table. And I said, well, we didn't. We cut away. And then when we cut back, the table's been flipped.
Mm-hmm.
So, but as an audience, you put it together that he flipped the table to get behind it.
Yeah, yeah.
But that was, we were shooting in Mike Combs' house, in his living room. And, you know, he let us do everything we wanted except flip the table. And I was like, well, that's all right. We'll turn it over very gently. Very gently. You got to be careful. It's like eggs. You have to be careful with eggs. So you flip it over. And then he got behind it. I was like, I'll just cut away and come back to it. But because as an editor, I knew how I was going to cut it.
It made sense.
Or how I could cut it, even if I didn't exactly know, I knew the cutaway would work, come back, it's been flipped, the audience just puts it together. So those are so many tricks that you learn, but you don't learn those tricks if you don't do it.
Exactly. And to go back to how I edit, I wanted to real quick mention that I don't put inserts or any B-roll shots in the first, like when I'm putting a scene together.
Oh, okay.
I focus on the dialogue, I focus on who's talking, and I put it in there. And then after the scene's done, I'll be like, okay, now I will feel the rhythm of the scene and see, okay.
Is that when you figure out where you want your reactions to be?
Exactly.
Okay.
So I'll put the scene together and not put the reactions. I'll just put, okay, here's this.
That's interesting.
Here's that. I'll put the dialogue shit in first.
Okay.
Then.
So you basically just cut it like a soap opera. Like, you just cut on whoever's talking.
Exactly.
And then go back and revise it.
And then sometimes on different dialogue pieces, I want to hear him say something, or if I want her reaction, or vice versa.
Just pop that over.
I'll just readjust some shots and overlap the audio. But like for like when she was like in the Lonely Matrimony, there's a scene where she's tapping, and when she does that,
okay.
You know, okay. I added those after I edited her dialogue and dialogue together.
That's interesting because I do it completely opposite.
So it's like I get the rhythm of the scene and I get the rhythm of the cuts and everything like that, and so I'm going to flow. So later I can, you know, when I'm first editing, it just makes my life easier.
Okay.
Later I'll just insert cuts or whatever because I don't have to use sound or something. It's just...
See, now the way I do it is, so first of all, with that, is I already know where I'm going to use my insert shots. So I go ahead and put those in.
I know when I do it, cutaways, but I want to see, like, if I want to move it somewhere else or something like that.
Yeah, but now I might revise it, but for the most part, I already know. Mm-hmm. Now what I do is as I'm watching a scene, like I'll watch the take or whatever and go, okay, that's good. And my main purpose for I'll always pick the last take that we shot. Almost always.
Same. I get the last
and
two.
I'll get the last one. See, I just do the last one and then I'll watch it. And if there's a line in there or something that's fucked up, I'll either one,
go to the previous shot.
Go get the previous take and see if that one's good. If I absolutely need it. If I don't absolutely need it, I'll cut away.
I do that too, actually.
And that's and that creates its own rhythm, right? So I don't worry about, again, it's this whole idea of like worrying about things being perfect.
I edit from the wide shots, by the way, first. If I have the widest shot first, I do that. I put that on the timeline. Okay. Then I go, I work in so from the wide and then I just move in. So like the close-ups I did, I added those. I was like, okay, so I'm watching this conversation. Where do I want to see a close-up?
Because you did that where you shot it more like in a medium and then, you actually reframed it in post, right?
Yeah, some shots, some dialogue pieces, I got actual close-ups. Yeah. But later I was like, I should have gotten this or that. So I would just
crop it
in a little bit. And you can't tell the difference.
Can't tell the difference. Because like every now and again, you're going to, like, people freak out. Oh, we got to reshoot that. The boom was in there. I'm like, oh, I'll cut it.
There's a boom in my shot. Like, I
reframed it.
I did it. I did, like, 16 fucking takes on this one shot.
Oh,
and
yeah.
And the last take was great. My elbow got in there.
Mm-hmm.
Beauty of fucking 4K. I can crop it a little bit. And you don't know what I did.
Okay, I'm going to give you a perfect example on guilt. So we shot. This cracks me up. So I don't want to give away the end, but at the end, there's a character who gets shot.
Mm-hmm.
Elizabeth goes over to this character and sits next to them, kind of having a moment, right?
Mm-hmm.
I won't give away who it is because you got to see the movie. But then we shot it in a Y. Now, this is at the end. This is the part of movie making that people don't think about because this is at the end of an 11-hour day.
Mm-hmm.
We're at about hour 10.
Yep.
So we're toast.
Yeah.
We're toast.
Yeah.
And we have to be at set the next morning. So we're toast, right?
Yeah, I think we're burnt toast.
We were burnt toast at that point. So we shoot this in a wide shot, and she sits down, she kind of grabs his hand, and she's sitting next to him. I go to edit this, right? Again, just shot it in a wide. He just got shot in his chest multiple times, like three times.
Mm-hmm.
What I was supposed to have done is taken the same black shirt that he had on, put holes in it with blood to create the bullet holes. Because you don't, when you see him get shot, the shots are in close-ups, so you don't actually see the bullets go in. But you see the after effect, right? So I'm editing it, and I was like, oh, fuck. Right? Completely forgot to get the shirt.
Yeah, you asked me, what's wrong with the scene? I was like,
so, I edited it. I had you guys watch it. Neither one of you picked it out.
Yeah.
That's good, because that means you're in the scene.
Yeah.
So that was why I asked that question, because I was like, okay, if they point it out, then maybe there's something else wrong with the scene. You guys are like, I have no idea. It looks fine.
Mm-hmm.
And I was like, supposed to have bullet holes. And you're like, no, motherfucker. Now, the other part of it is because the visual effects weren't in for the gun flash and the sound isn't in there. So maybe you didn't put together that yet.
Sure.
But so I was like, how the fuck am I going to fix this? And I was like, I'll crop it. So I cropped in. So I took that one shot and I actually cut it up into three shots.
Yes.
And I cropped into like a close up of her grabbing his hand. And that's our transition from the previous part of the scene to her approaching. Then I cut to a tilt up. Because the camera tilts just a bit. And I cut it from just above like his shirt to her face. And then she gets up and walks out and I just let her like exit. So there's a third cut. So I took one shot. And because I could crop it in all these different ways and you have no idea. And originally I cut it out of the scene. And then I was like, no, we have to have that emotional moment of her after that. After the after effect of that. So I put it back in and then I just cropped it. Again, that's that, and that goes back to most people be like, "Oh, we gotta go back and reshoot that."
They know.
No.
Nope. What about the?
That's called creative problem solving.
The scene where you got the insert shot of the blanket, remember?
Mm-hmm.
You crop in. How'd you do that?
Because you had insert shot of the blanket.
There was a scene in the woods, and you had to get a shot back and forth, and
I know you're
crop
going
in. Remember that?
Yeah. So there's a shot, and I'm trying to remember exactly what it was, but it was something like, I wanted her to have a reaction of just a blanket.
Mm-hmm.
So, and I didn't get that. But I did have the beginning of a shot. So after we started rolling, the girl that plays Stacy, the younger sister, walks into the frame. But there's about 4 seconds before she walks in the frame. So what I did is I cut the audio out and just cut from the beginning where the camera's still, because it's just like a tripod, it's just a still shot.
Mm-hmm.
and I cut it until right before she starts to walk in, and I cut it, and I just had this moment where it's just this field where it's like a clearing outside of the woods where they would sit and hang out as kids, and the blanket's just there. But it's cool because you see, like, the mountains behind it, and there's, like, drifting through because it had just rained and stuff. And I just snipped it from the beginning of a shot, and it was actually before I even said action.
Yep.
We're just rolling. And I was like, oh, I need a reaction to that. I was like, oh, wait. Right? Why go back and get it, right? It was the one thing I forgot to get that day, because that was that day in the woods where we were going nuts. So I just snipped it from the beginning of another shot.
And that's because, you know, and that's kind of like one of those, like, you're prepped.
Mm-hmm.
And even if you didn't get that shot, you still had a little bit of it.
Look, you're going to make mistakes. Yeah. You know what I'm saying? When you have all those moving pieces, you have weather that affects you, or a long day that you're tired, you're going to forget stuff, mm-hmm. right? That always happens. You know what I mean? So to be able to go into your footage, because I design the movie so much and I watch the footage, I pick up these little things like, oh, wait, I can grab that from that shot. And you just plug that in there.
Mm-hmm.
You always have to remember, the audience doesn't know anything except what you show them.
Mm-hmm.
So they don't know what your original intention were, or what your original script was. They don't care. They're just watching
what you're showing them. They just know what you have,
yeah. So you have to think about that. So from an editing standpoint, so just a broad lesson in editing, organize all your footage, right? So what I do is I create folders in the sequences of which I'm going to edit. So scenes 45 through 50.
Mm-hmm.
That's one folder. All my footage goes in there, and I have a folder for the video, and then I have a folder for the audio files. That's how I organize.
Yeah.
Find your way to organize, right? Everybody's going to do it a little differently. And then when I import, that way when I import my files into Final Cut, and then what I do, then I go in and I relabel them all so that they're described as scene 63, over the shoulder, take one, whatever, right?
Mm-hmm.
And I'll relabel them all, and I do all that. It's tedious, it's annoying, it's not fun, but it doesn't take that much time. And it'll save you so much time later. So it's just like outlining your script, right?
Yeah.
Outlining your script before you write it is the same prep that you do when you're organizing all your footage before you edit
it. And it just saves time in post. Like, you save time on set because you're not fumbling through and looking for things. And
right.
Where did I
and then
that?
If
where did I
you get into those moments like the blanket shot or the shot where I needed to cut into her when she's talking to the person that she
It's shoots. Creative problem solving.
It's creative problem solving. But because I went through all the footage and all the footage labeled, I can go, okay, I'm going to go to this scene. I need to find this shot.
Mm-hmm.
And I find it like that. I pull it in. I sync it up and I'm ready to go.
Mm-hmm.
Allows you to move at the speed of thought.
And be more creative with the, like...
Right.
It could be something to add that's like...
The idea of being organized and being prepared has this weird thing where people think it's stunting creativity.
You're putting yourself in a box.
Yeah, you're not putting yourself in a box.
Yeah.
Because you still have to be creative with how you put together a scene,
mm-hmm.
or how you write a scene, or how you shoot it, or whatever. You still have to be creative.
Mm-hmm.
The organization actually frees you from all the logistical shit that is boring and not creative, so that you can be creative.
Exactly.
So when you do run into a problem, rather than having to go, oh, I got to go back to set and reshoot this, unless you're shooting something totally new, right, that you didn't realize you needed until you started editing. I've had that happen before. It may happen, right?
Mm-hmm.
Or you're just like, you just come up with a whole new idea, like, oh, this would be really cool if I could do this. But you have to think about it when you get to larger scale stuff. It costs money to go back to set.
Right.
That's where all the money is spent, is on set. So if you can take footage that you already have and make it work for you, that's going to save you every single time.
And nobody's going to fucking know the difference.
Because think about it this way. In the long run, where you're working for a studio or a production company and you're making a movie or making a TV show or whatever, the more efficient you can be and the cheaper you can be means the more times you're going to get hired back. Right? So that's what we're all preparing for eventually, right? But from a micro-budget standpoint, you don't have any money.
Mm-hmm.
So unless you can go back to set, like if you're just going out to get some B-roll, right, and you just want to use that to create some atmosphere, that's cool. That's what.
Yeah.
Like, that didn't cost you anything. Mm-hmm. It's just you and a camera, right? So that's just you. But to get actors back out there, crew back out there, get permission to come back to the location, get all the props back out, all that stuff.
That's a whole thing.
It's a whole thing. So be creative with that, you know. Mm-hmm. So that's how I edited the movie, was doing it in between shoot dates. Now, a lot of people listening to this, they're probably going to shoot weekends, right, around their jobs.
Yeah.
So you could edit during the week. Mm-hmm. Here's the benefit of editing as you shoot, is you start to kind of pick up on things that you're doing, right? I started to pick up on performances, right? So I would tweak how I was directing the actors, or I may adjust some shots because I was like, oh, I picked up on whatever she's doing, or
I need this shot next time, or this, yeah, or that, or whatever.
And if just so happens you're going to be at the same location again and you forgot to grab an establishing shot, or I just need a shot of that doorknob,
mm-hmm,
you know what I mean, I want to cut that in as a cutaway,
mm-hmm,
whatever, you can go grab that. But you wouldn't know that if you weren't editing as you shoot, right?
And if you're in post and you shot everything, it's like, fuck.
Yeah. So, now, if I was shooting a bigger budget thing, I'll tell you the way I'd love to schedule, because they don't do this,
mm-hmm,
but I think this would be brilliant, is rather than shoot like a Monday through Friday or Monday through Saturday, whatever Hollywood dumbass does, what I would do is I'd shoot like Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, and then edit on Thursday and Friday.
Hmm.
Now, the crew gets 3-day weeks, and they're going to be like, what? Have all this extra time? Who's not going to want to work on that movie?
Yeah.
Right? If I'm shooting 18 days, instead of shooting that in 3 weeks... for 6-day weeks, right? If I could shoot that in 6 weeks, now the question becomes, does a union become an issue because now you got to pay them weekly rather than daily? That could be an issue with that, right? That's what I don't know, because I don't know the union rules on that. But that would be my preferred thing, because for the most part, I edit very fast. So I could put together rough cuts of every sequence that I shot those first 3 days and 2 days easy.
Mm-hmm.
Take the weekend off. Let your mind rest. Back to it Monday. Do that for 6 weeks. You shoot and edit an entire movie in 6 weeks. That's nuts.
It is nuts. And it's, yeah, I think that's a...
Now, that's an 18-day shoot schedule, which for the most part, if you're shooting a low-budget horror movie, even for a studio,
mm-hmm,
that's roughly going to be your shooting schedule for the most part. But even if you shoot it further out, right? Like, obviously, we're not going to be working on movies where they shoot for 100 fucking days or something, right? You wouldn't be able to do that. But that's where bringing in an editor has its benefits, because they can be cutting stuff together as you're shooting,
yeah,
and send you stuff, and you can watch it.
The Irishman had, what, over, like, what, 103 days?
Yeah, something like that. Right, that's different, right? So, but that's a whole different scale than what we're talking about.
Yeah.
But for micro budgets, shoot on the weekend, do 2 days. Don't try to cram 3 days in for the most part. Like, when we did this on Guilt, that first weekend, we shot Friday, Saturday, Sunday, Monday. So I actually took off work the Friday and the Monday, and then I scheduled the shortest days on the Friday and the Monday. And
yeah,
just right. Got the shuff. Mm-hmm. So we shot Friday night, like 6 to 10 or 11.
Mm-hmm.
So only like 4 or 5 hours. And we just got a bunch of stuff that I think only Elizabeth was in, and I think Karen was in a scene that we shot.
Yeah, right.
Where she played like the dark figure, mm-hmm, in the background kind of stuff. And then Saturday we shot like 1 to midnight, like 11 hours. That's where we shot the big stuff. Right, because we had some outside scenes during the day, then we had the climax stuff at night, and then Sunday we shot all the stuff with the parents, and then, because there's a lot of scenes in the house between Elizabeth and her parents.
Yeah.
And then Monday, the only thing we shot were a couple of shots in the bedroom, and then of just Elizabeth, mm-hmm, like where she wakes up from dreams.
Yeah, that was the...
And then, I believe that's when Ian came and did his scenes.
Mm-hmm.
And we knocked those out. And I think we were only on set that day like 4 hours or something.
Yeah,
stupid.
But it wasn't that long.
So, now, hindsight, if I could have moved the stuff we shot Monday morning to Friday afternoon, we could have shot all that in one day. Just shot Friday, Saturday, Sunday, and then done. That would have been better. But I didn't actually think that those scenes would go that fast.
Yeah.
I thought they would take longer. So, that's how we shot that weekend. Mm-hmm. The only reason we did that is because I was renting that house.
Mm-hmm.
And I rented it all in one weekend. Now, if that was a house that I had access to whenever, I would have broke that up into two different weekends and would have just shot like Friday, Sunday, or Saturday, Sunday, or something like that.
Right.
And just shot them on a weekend. So only reason I did it that way. Because all the rest of it I had access to, like basically each day was a different location almost. Mm-hmm. Like I think we only revisited the same location twice, if I remember correctly.
So, yeah.
Yeah. We went back to the therapy office scene we shot in 2 different days.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Everything else, like each location was one day. So this whole myth that you should only get one or two locations, that actually makes your movie harder. Because if you're going to shoot for 10 or 12 days, you've got to get access to one place for 10 or 12 days.
Yeah.
So you have to displace whoever lives there, works there, whatever, or work around their schedule for that many days. That actually makes it more difficult.
Oh, yeah.
When you have multiple locations, as long as, again, as long as you're writing it to stuff...
You can have access to...
Access to it. Yeah. You know, it's like, well, can I use your office on Sunday morning? I only need to get two scenes there.
Yeah.
Boom. Right? Then that actually gives your movie more scope. Right? But then when it comes to the editing... You're just editing what you shot that weekend.
Right.
You know what I mean? Then what you do is when you're... So when I was done, I put all the scenes in order. I went back and watched it. Made sure that my outro, like the shots that would exit a scene and then go into a scene, made sure that those worked.
Mm-hmm.
And then I found about four places where I was like, okay, I need a transition shot. So I had some stock footage of aerial shots of like neighborhoods that I had saved. Popped those in there. Color graded them to fit the look. And that's how I made transition shots. Other than that, I stuck pretty much to what I shot.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, because, I designed the movie a certain way. Then I sent the movie to you guys. And then I went back and made the revisions that I made where I trimmed down the scenes. But I would just go into those individual scenes and just revise those scenes. And then went back and rewatched the movie once that was trimmed to see what it looked like. Mm-hmm. And that's, you know, that's how we put it together. So then when I was done, so we had visual effects in one scene, which was the gunfire.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So I sent just that. I actually didn't even see that scene. I just saved that clip and sent it to him. He did the visual effects, sent it back to me, mm-hmm. and I popped it in there, and that was it. So then when I rendered it, basically, I just rendered it into like an HD, small HD file, and then I have a compression software where it compresses it down even more, so it's only like a couple of gigs,
right.
Like real small. And then I can upload that to the Dropbox, and I send that to my sound designer, and I send that to
the composer.
Now what I did with this was I did a little differently than previous films is once the movie was done and I color graded, I was like, okay, I got picture lock. It's done. I'm not changing anything. Cause you kept going, well, you can change this. I'm like, nope, picture lock. We're done. We're done. You got to know when you're done, right?
Yeah.
You can sit and tinker. I remember when I did Devil's Point with Chris, he kept going back and tinkering. I'm like, leave it alone. Distribute the motherfucker. That's what you need to do. Stop
yeah.
tinkering with it and distribute it. Right. Because nobody cares.
Mm-hmm.
It's just a movie. It's just a movie. So what I did with this is I then had my entire movie on my timeline, right? And I saved it as like one big clip. And then I went through the entire movie and I just pulled snippets that I wanted to use in the trailer. And that's how I started putting my trailer together.
Mm-hmm.
So then I cut the trailer. I think I sent the trailer to you for a rough cut. Got mm-hmm. your feedback. Made some tweaks based off of your feedback. Finalized the trailer. And then sent the trailer with the audio to the sound designer or composer first. Had them do... So, like, Ed, our composer, did a score just for the trailer. Like, he wrote one just for the trailer. Which is really cool. Because it gives it its own thing.
Oh, yeah.
So we did that. That way we could release the trailer. So then the sound design and mix and music were all done on the trailer. Then they started working on the movie. And Ed cracks me up because then he composes the music. And he knocks the score out in, like, 3 weeks. And I was like, holy fuck, dude. Like, I think he was done with the score for the feature before Celine was even done with the sound design of the trailer. That's how fast he did this score. And he's like, look, don't think that I work this fast normally. I've had this because he had had this plan for months and kind of knew what he was doing. And then he had something scheduled that got canceled. So he had all this extra free time. So he just went. He's like, I was just in that creative mode. And he's like, I just went at it. So that was what sort of freed him up. And that's how we did the score. So then he sent me the score. I laid it in and just watched the movie. It was the first time that I really could enjoy the movie, like, as an audience member.
Because
mm-hmm. I was watching it with the score, right? And I was just loving every second of it. And the only thing I had him tweak, this is the only thing I had to have him tweak in the whole thing, was the party music and the party scene.
Okay.
I had him tweak the music, like where it comes in and sort of what the music was. I had him tweak that. The rest of the score is exactly his first take.
Nice.
That's how well that came together. Because it's just so fucking good. And I was like, because him and I had a lot of conversations about the score, like talking about different mm-hmm. scenes and emotions and motifs and all this stuff. And he wanted a certain motif for certain things. And I was like, I love that. He just got the script immediately.
Mm-hmm.
So it was just the smoothest... I've ever worked with a composer before. He just, and this is his kind of movie, so it just sunk in really well. So basically, so then the score was done. So then he sent, the score broke up into I can't, I think they're called stems, if I remember correctly, mm-hmm. which is the files that Celine needs for the audio. So then at that point, Celine finished the sound design for the trailer, so the trailer's done. Now the score was done for the feature. Mm-hmm. Celine has everything he needs, and then he started working. And at that point, we just, my least favorite part is I'm sitting and waiting.
So after the sitting and waiting, what's go?
What's next? That's what I was about to ask. When do we have a distribution?
So
great right. transition, by the way.
Yeah, great transition. It's like you've done this before.
I'm just doing what I got.
I'm just doing what it comes at me. So distribution, what we want to do. So I have a list of distributors, probably about a dozen, that I want to send the movie to. Mm-hmm. My goal, what I would love to be able to do, whether I signed with a distributor or I don't think I would be able to do this directly. I would love to sell the movie to Shudder.
Okay.
Now, I am not the only
that's the fingers crossed
indie horror filmmaker out there that wants to get on Shudder, right? Because number one, Shudder pays their filmmakers a pretty decent amount of money, right? Not, you know, retirement money or anything like that. But if you're making a micro budget indie horror film and you can sell it to them, you're gonna make some money, right? That's all I care about. I don't need to retire off of this. You know, this mm-hmm. is not that movie.
You just wanna be able to make the next one.
I just wanna make enough that I can put a little in my pocket, pay everybody their back end points because we have investors. I also given some back-end points to some of the people that worked on it. And then have enough that left over for me that I can fund the next one and put a little in my pocket. And then the benefit of that is, on the next one, I don't have investors. Mm-hmm. So now I'm keeping a bigger chunk of the pie, right? Which then means I can put a little bit more in my pocket on the next one and fund the one after that. And just keep repeating that. That's what I really want to do.
What if that doesn't happen?
Figure it out. Like, what did I do wrong? Right? Okay. Why? What I would want to figure out is, why didn't this movie make money?
Do you have a plan B for if Shudder doesn't pick it up?
Yeah, so basically, plan A is, plan A is to sign with a distributor. Like, get a distributor. But I have, because of my past experience, I have a list of questions that I want to ask these distributors. And I tell everybody this. Mm-hmm. This is what you got to do. Ask them, if they release the movie, how do you make money? Where are you making money from right now? Because distribution's changed just since we started this fucking podcast. It's changed.
Oh yeah.
TVOD, transactional video on demand, is done. Mm-hmm. Hardly anybody rents movies anymore.
Yeah.
Why? Because we have 18 fucking subscriptions to, you know, HBO, Netflix, Hulu, Shudder, all this stuff. And fuck, now you got the free ones, right? Tubi, Roku, mm-hmm. Crackle. They're all AVOD. So everybody's either making money. You either sell your movie to a subscription based streaming service like Shudder, Netflix, something like that, which you're seeing. Hulu's got their own like horror movie series. Shudder has one. Tubi's got originals now, so they're doing indie horror. And some of the smaller AVODs like Roku and Crackle are even starting to do it. So those are good places that we could potentially sell our film. But you're not going to get into those services unless you're doing it through a distributor. Unless you have a sales agent that you signed with who could sell it to them directly. Mm-hmm. But it's going to be the same difference.
Right. Yeah.
Because mm-hmm. for the most part, if you go with a distributor is going to keep a 20% distribution fee. For the most part. Well, a sales agent's going to do the same thing. So basically, I want to get it into a distributor. Because here's why with a distributor. If you go with a distributor, plan A is you sell it to a streaming service. Whether it's Shudder, Tubi, doesn't matter who it is. And let's say we sell it to them for 50 grand or 75,000 or whatever, the 100 grand, whatever it ends up being, whatever the number is, we sell it to them for a flat fee. Then it's not distribution where you're making money as you go. It's a deal. Mm-hmm. They buy the movie outright. That's plan A. Plan B is they do the traditional distribution, which is where they release it on multiple services, and then maybe they sell it to one of these, like Shudder, for a licensing deal. So it's going to be in Shudder for a year. Well, Shudder pays less for that. Mm-hmm. Let's say if they buy it as an original, they may buy it for, say, 100 grand, versus if they buy it for a year, they may only pay 25 grand. So it just depends on the deal, right? So that's plan B, is hopefully we can get into, because that's just where the audiences are going for this stuff, right? So the benefit of being with a distributor is, one, the distributor would have access to sell to these streaming services if they sell it to them outright. I'll give you an example. There's a company called Terror Films.
Right.
And they mm-hmm. sold a movie called Hell House, which is like a found footage horror movie. Mm-hmm. And they sold it directly to Shudder. Well, then it did so well that they wanted sequels. So they went and made sequels, which they teamed with Terror Films. But then they went directly to Shudder. Mm-hmm. So that was just kind of how that particular movie worked out. So that's really what I want to do with it, because I feel like that's where we're going to make our money, is through a streaming service. If a streaming service doesn't buy it, then we'll end up going through the traditional distribution route, excuse me. But that's why I'm asking all these distributors that I interview with.
Yeah.
Basically, I want to send them the movie. Anybody that's interested, I'm going to set it up a time to meet with them. And then I ask them these questions. And I'm going to be outright. Like, look, here's what I want to do with the movie. How realistic is that? If we did that, what kind of money are we going to make? If they passed and we had to go to plan B, what's plan B? Where are we going to make our money from? If we put it on Tubi, if we put it on Apple TV, if we put it on Amazon, what are we going to make from that? Right? Let's put together a strategic plan.
Mm-hmm.
Next question is, how are they going to market it? Okay, I'm not doing a marketing cap of $10,000 because it's a complete and utter fucking waste. Nobody markets a movie for $10,000. You know what you're going to get for $10,000 marketing cap? A couple of interviews or a couple of reviews. That's it. So don't even bother with that. Because it's pointless. They're just taking money out of your pocket.
You can do that yourself.
Yeah. You know, then you also have to think about this. A lot of these distribution deals are 80-20 split. You keep 80, they get 20. How hard are you going to work for 20%? Right?
Mm.
So then I want to ask the question, well, how much harder would you work if we did a 50-50 split? No marketing cap. We each make money from dollar one. But you're going to keep half of it. I'm going to keep half of it. Would you hustle the movie more? Because that's what I need you to do. I need you to hustle this movie out there. Get through the bullshit. A lot of content out there, right? Think about it. There's the amount of people who watch TV is not much different than a few years ago. But now, instead of having, you know, three or four network TV channels and a movie theater with those movies coming out on DVD, you now have 18 different streaming services with 500 hours or 500 different shows or something,
right,
on top of the movies Hollywood's making, on top of the indie movies that are coming out, right? There's so much more content, but the same amount of eyeballs.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So how do you get through that stuff, right?
Mm-hmm.
That's why we're niching down, because with a paranormal horror movie, you're targeting the audience that loves those kind of movies. I'm a part of that audience.
Yeah.
There's a supernatural thriller, I'm probably going to watch it.
Mm-hmm.
Unless I watch the trailer and it looks like a complete piece of shit, I'm probably going to watch it.
Yeah.
Right? If you're like, she's haunted by something, I'm in.
I'm in.
Let's do that. I'm that audience, right? So that's the reason to niche down, because that sifts through all the crap, right? All the people who don't like paranormal horror movies are not our audience. Right? You're making your next feature is a 90s slasher.
Yeah.
People who like slashers are going to watch that. People who don't like slashers are not.
Exactly.
Cut and dry.
I know my
That's how distribution is going to work for us. So the way I looked at it is, I watched a lot of the movies on, either watch the movies or at least watch the trailers of a lot of the movies on Shudder, a lot of the horror movies on Tubi. I went and watched a lot of that stuff to see what kind of content, what kind of quality are they looking for. And I specifically went and found the other supernatural, paranormal style movies,
mm-hmm.
right? Even if they were a little different than mine, it didn't matter. If they had that paranormal angle to it, I watched the trailer. And then if it looked really good, I'd watch the movie. And I did that on like Shudder, Hulu, Tubi. Those are the big three that I really paid attention to. Like HBO, Netflix, they're no chance working on any of those places. And really paid attention to that. And that's what made me decide to do the Black Magic. Because I knew on the old camera, no chance I'm getting on Shudder.
Yeah.
And to elevate, and this is my seventh feature, right? So I knew that I was at a point where it's time to elevate.
Mm-hmm.
Or I was just going to be going around in circles in the same fucking place all the time.
Right.
So that's why I made that decision. Because now we have the quality of picture and sound that they need technically. I believe we have a very good story,
mm-hmm.
with good performances that was well executed. At least I hope so. The response so far that I'm getting from people who are always honest with me is good, is positive.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So I feel pretty good about that. And it's very, I mean, I try to be as objective as I can about my own material, but that's hard.
Mm-hmm.
That's hard to do. You know that. So I feel like we have a pretty good shot at getting into one of these places. If we get the right distributor that has the right relationship with Shudder or Tubi or whoever, that's going to be the key. So that's why I've sat down and I've kind of jotted down very specific questions that I have for these distributors.
Mm-hmm.
So we're going to do like a private screening for the cast and crew. I don't want to do a public one because then that ruins us for potential film festivals. I do want to go into horror film festivals because I will say this.
It would work well for horror film festivals.
Horror film festivals still do really well because horror audiences are...
Oh, yes.
They are diehard.
Yes.
Right? I would love to eventually get to a place where we could do like some of the like the fan fests or
that'd be something like that. Talk about
we don't have an audience yet. We don't have a full-blown audience for the movie yet, so I don't think that's probably going to happen with this movie. But I think that that could be something that we expand to eventually. Because again, like these horror, the horror audience is just dedicated. Like they are horror fans, and they will be for life, right?
Yes.
So if what I'm hoping happens is that Guilt finds its audience, this audience loves the movie. I'm going to go make another movie that's a totally different story, but in similar in style and, mm-hmm. and tone, and we create a built-in audience for the movies that I make. That's why specifically on the poster I put a William Chaffin thriller. It's my way of branding myself as a director. Mm-hmm. Just like you're doing where you're doing Naeem David's
The Quarrel. Yeah. Yeah.
Right? You're doing the John Carpenter approach. Yeah. I'm going more of the Hitchcock approach. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So, but that's how they branded themselves, right? So, that's how I hope to distribute. The question's going to be, does a distributor buy the movie outright, or are we doing a percentage split? Because if I go to a distributor and I'll be like, look, if you give me X amount of dollars, I'll sell this to you outright. Whatever you make is what you make. But this at least gives me profit to do what I want to do. And then gives you a chance to go make your money and you do whatever you want with the movie. As long as it's out there, I'm happy.
Yeah.
Right? What I would want is just some sort of reporting so I can have an idea of what it's made.
Sure.
I don't need to know
right.
what your profit and all that. What, did it make 150 grand? Did it make 200 grand? Like, because that sets me up for the next time. Because if I go back to that distributor, I can say, well, my last one did really well. So instead of paying me 50 grand for this one, pay me 75 grand.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Even though I know you made twice that.
Yeah.
But look, I know you need to make your money. I'm perfectly fine with that. It's capitalism, baby. But I want to make my money. But I've now built a name for myself, or I've had a success, so the next one has a chance to do even better, so let's you pay me a little bit more for that one. That's how I would love to sort of set the stage. And so my goal is to turn this into a business.
Mm-hmm.
Make one movie every year, direct one movie every year, sell it to a distributor, or sign with a distributor who can sell it to a streaming service, make profit and move on to the next thing. Just keep going. Because what's going to happen is, if I do that and my movies are profiting, Hollywood's going to come calling. Because Hollywood is not going to turn out a filmmaker that makes money.
Right? That's true. Yeah,
that's
true.
That's how Mike Flanagan did it. I know that because I worked with the same producer's rep that sold his first movie, Absentia, sold Streets of Syndicate. And that's how he did it with Absentia. And now look where he's at.
It's happened before. It's happened with other filmmakers that do that, and then they go off and make other things.
But the big thing is we recognize that it's not going to be one movie, and then suddenly you're famous and making all this money.
Yeah.
It's a building block. Mm-hmm. You have to look at it that way. Stop the lottery ticket mentality, and realize it's a building block.
Yeah,
and you're building a business.
Yeah, this will lead to other things.
And then if Hollywood comes calling beyond that, awesome. Like we have a connection potentially to Blumhouse. Mm-hmm. Which I'm going to exploit if I can. I don't know what's going to happen from that. Probably nothing, but maybe something comes from that. You never know if we even can make that happen. So,
there you go. Well, on that note, guys, that's where we are with Guilt at the moment. We're definitely going to keep you all updated with everything that goes on, so stay tuned. We're going to have a lot more cool content for you guys, and we'll see you in the next one. Bye.